This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. I'm Nick Gillespie, and I'm here today with Rebecca Goldstein, a philosopher and novelist whose work goes from rigorous analytic thinking, asking big human questions about truth, meaning, and morality, the author of 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, The Mind-Body Problem, and Plato at the Googleplex, a recipient of the MacArthur Genius Grant. I want to ask you what it feels like when you get that big, you know, check in the mail from Ed McMahon or whatever, the oversized check. Her new book and the main topic we're going to be talking about today is The Mattering Instinct, which asks the basic question, are our deepest convictions about what matters in our lives and who we are just feelings, or are they tracking something more real and even evolved? Rebecca, thanks for talking Reason. Yeah,
thanks for inviting me.
Let's start with the mattering instinct. Explain what that is.
So first of all, I'll say how I understand this term matter, which is such an interesting term. We've got the noun, we've got the verb, they're related to each other. But the verb to matter basically means to be deserving of attention. We talk about what matters, we talk about who matters. Deserving of attention, this is already very, very interesting because deserving is what philosophers call a normative term. It involves values. It involves norms of justification. Mm-hmm. What is really deserving? So when I and I think that's at the root of who we are, that mm-hmm. we're creatures of matter who long to matter.
Right. And we want to matter both to ourselves and to however we define society or our group.
Yeah. Well, some people actually will do away with the second. It's real. Okay. I think at root, and this sounds slightly paradoxical, we are trying to justify all of the attention that we have to give ourselves. I think mm-hmm. the mattering instinct, as I understand it, it may involve others, it may not, mm-hmm. but the core is we devote so much attention to ourselves. I mean, this is comes out of neuroscience.
Yeah, this doesn't just happen.
This doesn't just happen.
I spend hours every morning.
So. Yeah, that's right. And when we're fantasizing, what are we fantasizing about? You know, ourselves, our plans, our future, all these things. And we can step outside of ourselves, but, mm-hmm. you know, we have this evolved capacity for self-reflection and ask, hey, do I really deserve all this? How do I justify this? Mm-hmm. The way we evaluate and measure how much something matters, how much it's deserving of attention, is by how much attention we give to it. It mm-hmm. would seem that we each consider ourselves to be the thing that matters the most in all the universe.
But then there can become, I mean, it's both complementary or it can be destructive of that if what we base everything on is how much attention we get from people
from
around
others,
us.
Right. Yeah. So, but basically, and that's, I think, to me, it's a surprising idea. It's ourselves. We're trying to live in peace with ourselves. Right. And the consequence of really a feeling that you don't matter mm-hmm. is deep depression.
Do you know, I've been seeing more and more, kind of stories or essays, articles and whatnot, or discussions of like, we're in a crisis of meaning at a individual level and at a societal level. And, you know, this kind of, you know, question recurs. It's almost always backward looking. But do you think that's true? Do we seem, you know, and when I say we, I guess maybe North America or the United States in whatever year it is, 2026, are we in a particular moment where it seems like people don't know why, you know, people have deep misgivings about whether or not they matter, whether their lives matter, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I talk, of course, about a crisis of mattering. To mm-hmm. me, meaning is a subsidiary term. I define it in terms of mattering. But I do, because there's such, you know, there's such inequity mm-hmm. In our society, certainly income inequity. But, you know, going along with that is this inequity of mattering distribution. Some people matter so much more.
Yeah. Do you think that, but is the crisis of mattering, is that more condensed among kind of like, you know, upper class or upper middle class, upper educated people, and not so much among, you know, the striving masses? They know what they need to be doing every day.
And I think the striving masses feel it very, very keenly. Mm. And I think that it has a lot to do with the political disruptions that we've been, the populism, the
That reflects it, right?
Certain politicians know how to play to this sense of aggrievement that these.
So people, you're talking about Bernie Sanders, right?
Of course,
that it is true that there's, it's interesting. We're recording in New York City, and when I talk to a lot of people I know who are Zoran Mamdani fans, particularly younger people, they say something that I remember hearing during the Clinton years, the early Bill Clinton years, as well as some, and this is hazier for me, in my college days during the Reagan years, but people saying, I like, you know, that person because they make me feel like I'm part of something bigger than myself.
This is the interesting thing about our species. I just have to get in like a little praise for our species, that it's not enough, like all the other creatures, to struggle for, food and survival and reproduction, just going along the way the genes want us to go. Mm-hmm. We want something more. We want to convince ourselves that we're worth this effort.
Right.
And that's amazing. And without it, there is, either it's turned inward and there's deep psychological self-loathing. Unfortunately, you know a lot of people who have suffered severely from depression. The paradigmatic thing they say is, I don't matter. I never will. Others do. I don't. And some of these people are brilliant, but it can be, and that's an existential crisis, but society can be in an existential crisis. And I think it is.
Yeah.
I think it is.
And where does the mattering instinct come from in the book? I mean, you talk about it as, it's both evolutionary, but it's also you're struggling against the people who reduce everything to kind of mere biology or chemical reactions.
We are too complicated and perplexing for that. Mm. This need to justify, that's not written into the Darwinian script. Mm-hmm. Once we had this capacity for self-reflection, the story becomes so much more complicated. Where it ultimately comes from, the mattering instinct, is the second law of thermodynamics, law of entropy.
Right, and that's where there's something, some kind of structure, some kind of organization tends to dissipate over time.
It does, yes. I mean, the direction of time is the direction of from order to disorder.
Right.
And so all biological creatures are struggling against
this is
entropy.
What, keeping it tight
keeping
is the struggle
tight.
Against entropy.
Exactly
and that can
right.
be mental, psychological, physical.
That's right. And of course, entropy will get us at the end, obviously.
Gets everything. Speak for yourself, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
I will. I won't be around to see.
So it comes, it comes partly, it is kind of it's evolved, but it's more than that. It's a reflection of our ability for introspection.
Yeah, stepping outside and asking for justification. I think, I don't know, it's a credit. As our species tries my patience very often, I still, there's something kind of glorious about this. There's a kind of dignity to trying to justify your own self-mattering, which is built into the organism.
Is mattering ahistorical? How does sociology, how does history, how does technology factor into this stuff? Like, do we have the same, we might have the same mattering instinct that you write a lot about the ancient Greeks.
Yep.
You took Plato to the Googleplex, which is kind of fun. Did Plato and Socrates think of mattering in the same way we do, or what forms does it take over time?
So one thing that I should certainly say is, although I try to show how it's generated by the basic laws of physics and biology's response
and psychology,
to physics
really,
and
too.
Psychology the
or
neuroscience, the
consciousness,
all this stuff has to, but certain sociological factors have to be in place when you're struggling 24/7 for survival,
yeah,
for yourself, your kin, your tribe, mm-hmm, you don't have the luxury of saying, right, "Am I worth it? Do right I deserve it?" You're just,
but you also yeah are arguing this is not a luxury. This is not a luxury good, right? This is something that, and particularly in a place like America, in this year, you know, everybody has the luxury of time, right? Nobody is foraging for their next
exactly
calorie.
Exactly. Everybody has the luxury of making themselves perfectly miserable.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
No, it's kind of nice that way. It's very democratizing.
It is. It's yeah progress right yeah now. We can now yeah all worry about these existential problems.
Right.
But you actually, you know, in terms of history, you know, I argue, along mm-hmm with others, it emerges at a very specific time in various parts of the globe. Mm-hmm. We call that the Axial Age. It's when mm-hmm the religions that are still extant emerged, mm-hmm, and in the Greek world,
right,
Western philosophy and Western tragedy. Mm-hmm. You know, Greek tragedy is filled with this existential longing. What am I, creature of a day? You know, this sort of thing.
Right.
How do I give some substance to
part
my life?
Part of, you know, in this work, in the Mattering Instinct, but also your previous work, it's also, you know, what happens after those kind of traditional religions, you know, the Abrahamic religions, as well as things like Hinduism, Buddhism,
Confucianism, whatnot.
Yeah,
all of
you
them
know,
yeah,
they clearly don't have the magic that they once had.
Certainly, you know, not the Abrahamic, although
yeah
they seem to, there seems to be a resurgence.
Well, you know,
because I would say the crisis of
yeah
Mattering.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, some, yeah, I mean, it's interesting in the United States, I think the most serious religious demographers, all of whom are religious, will
yeah
say, I want this to be happening, but there really is no increase. We're increasingly secular, you know, and that's just the way it goes.
But yeah, how are you going to keep them down on the farm?
So then how do you, yeah.
After they see, yes.
In, you know, kind of in the modern age or in modernity, starting with, you know, the early modern period or the Enlightenment, what forms does the Mattering Instinct take that are kind of dominant and
yeah
that might still be in our discourse?
It comes out in many different personalized, mm-hmm, kind of bespoke mattering mm-hmm projects, but there's a pattern to mm-hmm them, and I see four different patterns.
Right.
And one is the ones that I call the transcenders,
right,
who really cannot understand what mattering can possibly mean if you don't matter to the cosmos mm-hmm at large. You know, that there must be some trans-empirical being who created mm-hmm everything, the laws of nature without, the moral order within, and who mm-hmm purposefully created you. That notion of being purposefully created,
yeah,
intentionally created.
Is there an archetypal transcender?
An archetypal transcender,
like a figure, you know, is it a Mother Teresa?
Mother. I mean, the people who write to me constantly, which yeah is, what gets you up in the morning mm-hmm if you don't believe in God? You just think that you are this random creature mm-hmm floating around on this random rock, and mm-hmm and you're going to die, and it's all going to. Oh, who's that Christian apologist? William Craig Lane or William Lane Craig or something like that. I once actually found myself on a stage with him and Jordan Peterson.
Okay.
Lovely experience. Can't begin to tell
I
you.
I can imagine.
Yes,
yeah,
yes, yes. But he you know, he yeah really put forth this view, like, how can you possibly think
right
that your life has any meaning
right
at all? You know?
So some people find meaning in that, of trying to transcend that, you know, the void, right?
You were created. You were purposefully
yeah
created. Figure out what God wants from you. Of course, you know, people come to very different views about
yeah
what God wants
right
from them, and has led to much bloodshed and continues to lead
to
much bloodshed. But yeah, all you have to do is, but without that,
there's nothing.
And having been born into that way
right
of thinking, and having, because I am a serious, I was a serious, solemn child. I took it very, very seriously.
Yeah, and you were raised in a very Orthodox Jewish setting and stayed in that life for a long time.
Yeah, well, I became an atheist when at the age of 13,
right,
but I made a vow to be like Spinoza.
Yeah.
I had already learned about Spinoza. He waited until his parents had both died before he pronounced his...
So he's like John Kennedy Jr. waiting until his mom died before he could get married. But that's nice of you. But Judaism is also one of those religions where you can be an atheist but still be an observer.
That's right. There's no such thing as... Anyway, there's no such thing as that.
Okay, so there's the transcenders is one type of, you talk about a mattering map and quadrants. Another one is the competitive people.
Yeah, and let me just say, having been a transcender, there is no sense of mattering like the sense of mattering. Yeah. I understand what that feels like. Oh, my God. You know, God is watching. It's terrifying, but it's also... Yeah.
I get chills when I think. I had a lot of friends who were evangelical Christians, and I'm a fan of Bob Dylan, who went through an evangelical phase, and he has
and Orthodox Judaism too.
That's right, and he has a song about every grain, how God has, numbered or labeled every grain of sand.
Yes,
which reminded me. I interviewed Richard Dawkins a year or so ago on his farewell tour, and the way he talked about how Darwinian evolution is inscribed on every aspect of the universe. I was like, God, you sound like Bob Dylan in his Christian period. There's that's the transcenders. That's hugely powerful if you can do that, right? Or if that speaks to you.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So and, then, and I have, I have sympathy for it.
And there's secular versions of that.
Exactly.
Right?
As long as you're not doing any harm.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go to the other types, though. There's the competitive.
Competitors. So, and this, by the way, I've been thinking about this for over 40 years now. I never planned to write a book about it. Mm-hmm. But in my very first book, The Mind-Body Problem, it had emerged, this idea of mattering. And I thought it was interesting.
Just spring, from nothing? Or, obviously, you have been trained as an academic philosopher and whatnot, but that concept and that terminology really, seems like it's your big idea that you're working through in many of your books.
Actually, one way or the other, in all of the books, whether fiction or philosophy, always the book. Yeah. And it seemed too big an idea to me to actually tackle. It was like, who am I? Who do I think I am? Spinoza. Yeah. it came about when I was doing something which I considered and my colleagues considered very, very frivolous, which was to write a novel, which just, that just came to me. I just heard
and
it.
You were at Barnard at this
I was teaching at Barnard
College.
Yeah.
You were untenured.
Untenured, yes.
And you were ridiculous enough, and it's kind of funny, rebellious enough to write a novel rather than writing a well-reviewed novel as to boot. Rather than a scholarly monograph.
Yeah, yeah. I remember I used the summer vacation because I just heard it. It was there waiting to be written.
Yeah.
I wrote, a boring little journal article, try to get tenure, that sort of thing. And then I just wrote
but
that.
But you're also not putting that down either, right?
Very Catholic in my appreciation of all sorts of forms of creativity.
Before we run out of time. We've got... transcenders, we've got competitors. How do they make themselves feel like they matter?
They've got to matter more than others. It is a zero-sum game, adversarial. Yeah. If somebody exceeds them in mattering, it hurts. It hurts.
Yeah. And so is that and obviously there's going to be a gradient, but it's like every day they've got to be like, I've got to get to the coffee machine first. I've got to close the sale. I've got to, write the bigger journal article or the bigger novel.
That's right. Yeah. And so it may be in every sphere. It may be just,
In one.
Yeah. Where they are. So my favorite story about that is a scientist that I know quite a little bit. And he, very good scientist, and he actually got a Nobel Prize. And then another friend of mine who knows this guy said, he was happy for all of 15 minutes. And then he thought, other people have gotten this Nobel Prize too.
Yeah, that's right.
And
look at you have a MacArthur Genius Grant. So, he probably was kind of constantly sizing you up, right?
I don't think I was on his radar.
Okay. Right.
Yes,
fair enough.
Yes.
But so the competitive or the competitor model is one way of mattering.
Yeah.
And with all of these things, it's kind of like, You could probably, if you did a deep analysis of each person, you would figure out, it's because you know, their mother was this way or their father, or you know, or it's just an inborn temperament.
But
it comes from a lot of different causes.
Yeah. Psychologists do, there are the tests or how competitive, there are different kinds of competitiveness. And you can take a test and see how innately competitive, but you know, by temperament you are.
Yeah, you live in Cambridge, right, or in the Boston area. Larry Bird, the great Boston Celtic player, he supposedly at every level of everyday life he had to win. So if we were walking towards that door, he would have to get there first. Coin flips, whatever.
I spent a lot of time commuting by car from New Jersey into New York, and I could tell by the people who would cut me off. Oh man, you're a competitor and everything, aren't you?
So then there's the socializers.
So and we all, in some sense, are socializers. We all need people in our life. Almost all of us. I've known a few mathematicians who don't, but that we're gregarious creatures. We need people who are going to pay us attention, whether we deserve it or not.
Right.
Those are our family, friends, lovers, whoever. Sometimes colleagues, but socializers. When I would speak to them about this, I don't know how many, maybe 1,000 conversations I've just had with people about this. They just immediately supply the phrase "to others." You mean you're talking about mattering to others? They just hear that, and that's, you know, that's what it means to them. Mm-hmm. It may be people who are already in their lives. You know, the mother who is living for her child, this professor's living for their students, or it could be to, you know, masses of people. You want to be an influencer. You want to be famous. That's a very strong method of trying to get mattering, that you matter, you know, to hordes of strangers. Of course, therefore, you are deserving of your own attention.
Right.
So it's very, very strong.
Yeah, we often, I mean, this is in a lot of novels, movies, and dramas where people, you know, they matter to the masses, but then they're horrible to the people immediately around them, or vice versa.
And some of the people, you know, I've lived this strange life. I've actually gotten to meet really famous people.
Yeah.
And for some, and I asked them, you know, does it make you happy? And for some of them, it's a pain. You know, at first it seemed desirable, and then it's a pain. And for some of them, they love it.
Yeah.
They love it. So,
okay. And then there's the heroic strivers, which is the category that you put yourself in.
Yeah.
What are heroic strivers, and how do they make, how do you make yourself matter?
Yeah. So they're, heroic strivers have some kind of standard of excellence in mind. It could be more than one. And they need to approach it, get closer and closer to it, feel like they're making progress toward it in order to feel like they matter. It can be intellectual, artistic, athletic, ethical. I'm really interested in atheist saints.
Like who is an example of that?
There was this guy, Baba Amte, who I write about in the book. He totally fascinates me. He set out to redeem lepers, people who suffer from leprosy.
To redeem them, or just to offer aid and comfort?
But to give them human dignity.
Okay.
And, you know, and he would have them, you know, he had a retreat out in the middle of no man's land.
Course, and. Right. And what's fascinating is he was not religious.
He hated religion. Yeah, he would never allow a priest.
You know, I was raised Catholic, and there's a long tradition of Catholic saints.
That's right.
And orders of nuns who would be like, okay, I'm going to the leper colony. I will never see
you
again.
Mother Teresa,
And that's powerful. I mean, I get chills a lot, I think, as I'm getting old and I'm going through male menopause. But also when I think of people, but that was in a religious context. So they're kind of doing the transcendent thing.
Exactly.
This
so this is pure, pure doing it for
ethical.
And he had
striver.
A real heroic striver temperament. He could have been like a, I don't know, another Che Guevara, or or a great entrepreneur or something. And he, the whole story is so interesting. He was coming home, and he was living a kind of heroic life, but going in many, many different directions. He was born into great wealth. And he saw a heap of garbage on the street when he was coming home one night. It turned out to be a leper, and the last, I shouldn't even use that word leper, a person suffering from leprosy and who, you know, was in the last stages. And he, you know, I mean, it's a horrible thing. Worms already eating at his eyes and everything. And he fled discuss terror. Mm. He could not reconcile his image, his heroic image of himself, with somebody who would flee from a defenseless person.
And this is all not as an imitation of Christ. This is just as a human being who is trying to commune with other humans.
Yeah, but it was his own self-image. It was, he had been praised by Gandhi as being courageous. He stood up to some people who were attacking a new bride. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and so he went back and ministered to this person until he died. Wow. and made it his life. His mattering project to have a place where people suffering from leprosy would go.
With that having to be lectured by religious people.
Exactly. And he would never allow a priest into his house. He really disliked, which is interesting. I mean, he's gone now, and I just read everything mm-hmm. that's been written about him, because he is the purest example I know of a non-transcender, ethical, heroic striver.
Yeah. Hey, Reason Interview listeners. Do you know a student looking for a serious intellectual experience that strengthens the foundations of a free society? Reliance College invites students ages 16 to 24 to the 2026 Great Connection Seminar in Chicago from July 25th to August 1st. This year's theme, Reason and Love, explores the ideas that shape character choice and human flourishing. Students engage directly with thinkers like Aristotle, Ayn Rand, and Alexis de Tocqueville in small dynamic discussion groups where every claim requires evidence and reasoning. They don't sit through lectures, they practice thinking for themselves. Outside the seminar room, students explore Chicago's cultural landmarks, analyze art firsthand, experience live improv comedy, and build friendships rooted in shared intellectual ambition. Parents, if you want your student equipped to reason independently, speak confidently, and contribute meaningfully to a free society, this program was built for them. Registration is just $900, and that includes room for the full week with scholarships available. Visit reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. That's reliancecollege.org/reason. So you give a kind of explanation of, okay, what are the types of strivers? Where does the mattering instinct come from? Or the types of mattering projects and the kind of, you know, archetypes that people do. And then you talk about, like, how is a life that is worth mattering, or that's not, that's a terrible, I'm saying, like, life worth living, but the successful mattering projects, you say, are rooted not in the pursuit of happiness, but in the pursuit of eudaimonia, which is one of these terms. I obviously mispronounced it, and I'm overeducated, but this is one of the words that comes from the Greeks.
Yes.
That is it eudaimonia or eudaimia?
Eudaimonia.
Pronounce it properly.
I say eudaimonia. Okay. I mean, but there are disagreements.
I have like I'm sure everybody has a secret cache of words they have no idea how to pronounce, but you've lived with for 20 years. But I'm sorry, pronounce the word again and then explain
eudaimonia,
why
yeah.
the pursuit of this is the way that you get to a mattering that is successful.
You know, it's the sense of flourishing in your life, and it can tolerate a lot of disappointment, mm-hmm. misery. I mean, if you're a heroic striver, there's going to be a lot of frustration, disappointment. Yeah. It comes with the project, but with other things as well, you know, and other mattering quadrants. It's not the day-to-day happiness. Mm-hmm. It is this much more long-term view we take of our lives, of mm-hmm. our lives in general. And you know, when we feel that, this is going as it ought to be going.
The ups and downs, all the struggles, setbacks, victories, et cetera.
You know, there's interesting, tests that really show this split. So you take people who are have young children mm-hmm. to raise, yeah. and you know, mothers who are staying mm-hmm. at home and doing this, and you know, day to day, if they keep a happiness diary, their happiness goes down. But if you mm-hmm. ask them, would you trade this life for another? So this kind mm-hmm. of counterfactual
right.
question: would you trade this for one without kids? No, their life satisfaction has gone up. You
right.
know, they would not want another life. This is what they want to be doing, even though there are great periods of frustration, utter right. boredom, you know, raising a little kid. And I've raised two. So
yeah, I'm on my third. So yes.
Yeah,
And it's, I mean, it's interesting because both as a child and as a parent, there are these intense moments of boredom,
yeah.
which seem to be somehow powerful shaping events in people's lives.
Yeah. And some people really, you know, there's so much diversity in our species. You know, right. we're all alike in needing to somehow right. justify ourselves to ourselves. That's what we share. The way we minister right. to this is so diverse and so many factors come into it.
Yeah, and this is fascinating in the book where you're saying, I mean, there's so... You know, and this is an ancient kind of thing that needs to be done, is where you are, you're justifying the universal, or you're comparing the universal and the very local.
Exactly.
So it's universal that we have the mattering instinct, and then the way that we kind of fulfill that is going to be kind of endlessly proliferating.
Exactly.
But the way to do that is by having a sense not that you're just living for the moment, but for this long-term mattering project.
Mattering is itself a kind of, you know, it's an interest, it's a self-reflective mm-hmm. Instinct. That's what makes it, you know, it's sort of hidden there.
Is that mostly, do you think, or in your best of all possible worlds, would that be, you know, partly a function of education, of formal education and informal education? Or how do we, you know, if... Many people today, particularly young people, are like, I don't know what I'm going to do with
yeah.
my life. And I have more options than I would have had 50 years ago,
yeah,
or
yeah.
100 years ago,
yeah.
or 500 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, should they be taught, okay, your life is a mattering project that's going to unfold over decades.
And you really can change it, you
yeah.
know, mid-course.
Right.
It takes courage. Mm-hmm. But if it's not working for you, you know, you change it. So, you know, I think there are three criteria that we mm-hmm. have to use. And it's going to, you know, is it working for me?
Mm-hmm.
Does it make me... keep me engaged in my life, give me the impetus mm-hmm. to push against entropy and see mm. my way into the future with some degree of enthusiasm.
Right.
Does it not undermine other people's sense mm-hmm. of mattering? So there's that moral component.
Mm-hmm.
Third, you know, that's the heart, you know, is it adding something mm-hmm. to our struggle, all biological struggle mm-hmm. against entropy? Is it on the side of creative order,
right?
As opposed to entropic yeah. disorder? You know.
Can I ask? Is that? I mean, this sounds very much. Well, here, let me backtrack a little bit. You know, I've been working at Reason Magazine for 30 plus years, and you know, it's libertarian, kind of classical liberal.
Yeah.
And when I first joined the magazine in 1993, and I moved from Buffalo, where I was in grad school, to L.A., where the main office
was. Was it political
located.
Theory that you were in grad school?
No, it's English. Or American literature, actually.
Oh, okay,
so,
good.
Which mattering, not in that phrase, but that's the whole American project, particularly the way Americanists used to talk about American literature. It's like you hear, you know, you're given all of this opportunity, all the distinctions of old Europe, everything's up for grabs. There's a new continent, and obviously there's, you know, there were people living here and all of that. But it's like,
yeah.
go make your life interesting. Go, you know, go pursue happiness,
yeah.
you know, but respect the life and liberty of others.
So, yeah.
I mean, this, what I'm getting
classical
at is that
liberalism.
Reason in its early years, what was fascinating to me was there was a lot of talk about the psychology of freedom. Like what kind of individuals are going to do better in a world where they have more choices
yeah.
rather than less choices?
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah.
often they were talking about economic choices, but also cultural choices, sexual choices, gender choices. Like
yeah.
when, you know, in the late 60s and early 70s, a lot of those old encrusted hierarchies and just stultifying forces were breaking down.
Yeah.
And what you're talking about seems very relevant to that. And it also seems very modern in the sense of, you know, back in the days of the Greeks, they were like, well, you don't really care about other people because you're either a natural, you know, master or a slave, right?
That's right. Yes. Some are born to be masters, some by, you know, yeah. Aristotle said that.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, and so this.
He who spoke so much about eudaimonia also said that, yes.
So, I mean, this is part of what happens in modernity and with people like Spinoza and whatnot, where it's not just, you know, you start to think more as an individual, but that, you know, that individualism is universalized so that everybody has the right. It's not just the king who gets to kind of live out his life.
Yeah. So, yeah. And I actually think, you know, in a sort of very abstract way, one can argue, and utilitarianism argues it, Kantian deontological theory argues it, just about every ethical theory argues it. I mean, all people matter, you know, but that's not going to solve our mattering at stake, right?
No, because I matter first, right?
You don't have to be
Ayn Rand to say,
exactly.
Like, you know, but
I got to live with myself, and I know how deserving of attention I think I am. Come on, you know, prove it to yourself, right, in some way or other.
You have two kind of extended examples in the book, including another malapronunciation. First of an ex-neo-Nazi named Frank Mink,
I think.
Mink. Yeah. Okay. Who was a skinhead who was from Philadelphia, but he actually got converted to skinhead stuff in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
Amish country.
Although he's not Amish, and they weren't Amish skinheads because they can't use like modern razors to shave their heads or something, probably, right?
They'd have to use tweezers.
It just takes too long. Okay. We're old before. Explain who he was and how he fits into the book because it's kind of amazing. And then also you were like doing a kind of intrepid reporting because you hung out with him, right?
Oh, yeah.
And you mentioned in passing that like of the 1,000 neo-Nazis I had contacted, he was like the one who got back to you or something like that.
Yeah, and I really wanted to understand this. I should say, you know, that when I talk about competitive mattering, for some it's the group. I matter more because I belong to this group.
Right.
And if some other group that is, you know, I judge to matter less is rising, that can become your mattering project to put it to rights again.
And the way he talks about getting involved in a kind of skinhead culture, that's exactly that.
That was exactly it. So I wanted to talk to one of these people. And so I contacted, you know, I went on Reddit and I'm reading all this stuff, you know, incels and Nazis. Yeah. And I'm trying to get in touch with them. And, you know, given my name, Rebecca Goldstein, none of the Nazis wanted to talk to me.
That's right.
Woman, too. Yeah. So and then I contacted this guy. I had seen him on a documentary. And he was already coming out of it and was seeing it more objectively. And I tried very hard to get in touch with him. And then I did. I called him. And then, I flew out to L.A. and we hung out and we still sometimes communicate.
And he had an experience where he ended up going to jail
at 17
prison.
As a felon. He committed terrible crimes. He will tell you that he committed terrible crimes. And and he went to jail. Then that was the first chink in this armor. He came from terrible circumstances, family circumstances, where he felt literally he did not matter. He would come home from school. He's an eighth grade dropout. Very, very intelligent, but an eighth grade dropout. And he would come home from school and try to be hit by a car. I mean, this was, you know, true.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, childhood depression. Then, you know, then he meets these people and it's like, you matter more than all of these other people who are stealing your mattering from you, the mud people organized by the Jews. So, you know, that was the ideology. And in jail, he became very good friends with two black guys. Right. And so that was the first chink.
Yeah.
And he
started to realize they were as human as any of the whites he knew or whatever.
Exactly.
And in fact, more so. Yeah, because they were empathetic.
Exactly. And they were all, they're young guys worrying about the their girlfriends, you know, while they're inside. Are these women going to be faithful to them? He says, there ain't nothing more human than guys worrying, about whether the women are going to be faithful to them. He puts it much better. Anyway, he comes out and he can't get a job. He's eighth grade, dropout, fell in with a great big swastika and knuckles that say skinhead. So when he beats somebody up, they'll know why. I think Goebbels was on his chest. Nobody wants to hire him, right?
No, that's right.
And he
makes a joke about like the swastika showed that he was like management level. Right?
That's right. Yeah. We need this guy for management. Yeah. And then finally he takes some temp work with a guy. He gives him the last name Goldstein. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I don't think that was his real name.
Right.
And this guy takes him on and kind of mentors him, treats him with dignity, and makes him feel like he has some potential. Yeah. And he was, at first, he struggled so hard against it. It was the last thread of that ideology that he had clung to so desperately. And, and it finally goes. And then he has to remake himself. And what he has devoted himself to is to try to peel the what is it that covers our eyes, peel the something away from of others, who are caught by ideologies.
Right.
He's doing penance for the early part of his life.
How would you classify him? Is he a socializer? Is he a heroic striver?
He's a heroic striver. I think he always was a heroic striver.
Yeah.
And it's now taken.
And he also found out through a 23andMe test, right, that he's also genetically, he's like 2.5% Ashkenazi.
Yeah, but because it's matrilineal, being Jewish, he is Jewish. He's considered, rabbis considered Jewish, which he takes great pride in.
Yeah, and that's kind of interesting, the idea that, and he was far enough along where he kind of treats that as like confirmation of what he already knew to be true.
Yeah.
But the idea that somehow in a psychological or an internal mental map that something physical, like a physical marker,
it clicked.
Could really.
Yeah. And, he jokes that he's a better Jew than I am.
Right.
He told me, it's okay. Yeah. He asked me about, my beliefs and my practice rituals. Yeah. He said, I hope you're going to hell.
Yeah. Okay.
jokingly. Right. Yes, he doesn't believe in hell. Anyway,
and
he's a terrific guy.
And I also read, following up just a bit on him, he's married to the woman, an actress who was in Smallville, who was part of the NXIVM cult.
Exactly.
In upstate New York,
exactly.
Which
so
is kind of fascinating.
Yeah, this happened, quite recently that they connected and bonded and both have this very interesting history, which are in certain ways parallel, so getting caught in something because of some real dearth, privation, deprivation in
and
the psychology.
Sometimes that's material, often it's kind of emotional or psychological or whatever. The other
we're just such interesting creatures.
We
really are.
Well, two other people, and I'll butcher their names. These were Chinese people who you mentioned in mainland China, Liu Zhaojing.
Yeah,
and
Lao
Li
Xiang,
Zeng.
I think. Yeah, Lao Xiang.
Could you explain who they are and why? I mean, they're towards the end of the book.
Yeah, I actually pretty much close with them.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is another, I'm trying to make this point that we sort of intrinsically know what it is to have a good mattering, We make a lot of mistakes, but a good project, that we really do. We know that certain things are worth devoting your life to. It varies with which one, knowledge or justice or beauty or, compassion, what is. And these things usually involve, great work against entropy.
Yeah.
And so, and And in general, you know, to be on the side of life against entropy, in general, is a good thing. This is a good thing. And I wanted somebody who really, to me, manifested this in the clearest way possible, just the way Baba Amte, you know, is such a good example of a non-transcending saint and a non-transcender, ethical, heroic striver. This was a woman who was born into the worst circumstances, societal, in China during the Civil War. She was orphaned at about 3 years old. Who knows how she survived? She had absolutely nothing. She becomes a trash collector, picking up trash and bringing it to recycling, getting her few, whatever, keep body and soul together. It was at the time of the one-child policy in China, to fight against overpopulation. Right. And, you know, who, if you can only have one child, who you want a boy.
Right, yeah.
That itself in that society, has to do with mattering. Right. You know, boys mattered more than girls. Right. It's many societies, right? Boys matter more than girls. And so what she found were baby girls being thrown out, newborn baby girls in the trash, in the dumpster, in the public toilet, on the side of the road, under the bridge. And she knew that every child is precious, and she, you know, with absolutely nothing, not literally not a roof over her head, brought these into the little hovel that she had constructed, she and her then partner, and he brought them up. She brought over 30 girls, and though she couldn't bring up, she found homes for them. She never left a child. She never left an infant. I had the She was gone when I found out about her, but one of her daughters, Juju, I spoke with her, and she was she was found under a bridge. The way she spoke about her mother, when I asked her, do you ever wonder about your birth mother? You know, would you, through genetic testing, would you want to find her? And, you know, she started crying and said, I had the greatest mother who could possibly have lived. Every child who passed through her hands was privileged.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, it makes me cry.
It's an incredible story.
It's an incredible story of a, what do I call her? She's just someone who really knew.
Do you have any access to her internal mind? Like, how did she think about this?
Yeah, so she loved children. She just loved, she had such a deep knowledge of how important a human life is, you know. So the last child she found and brought up was a boy, terribly, terribly tiny, probably about 2 pounds. Neighbors thought that it was probably a teenage girl who gave birth to this child found somewhere. And she called him the word that means rare and precious, you know, and that's what she knew about each child. And she knew a truth. That is true. She just knew this truth.
Let me ask.
She was illiterate, by the way. All the children were sent to school, learned to read. But that was so important to her.
You know, when you say, and I agree with you, like, we know that this is the right thing to do, or that what she is doing, whether we could do it or not, or would do it, is something different. But we know what she's doing is right. A lot of your work is kind of showing how ethical systems exist, you know, beyond traditional religion, which a lot of people, you know, in the very old argument that, like, if you don't believe in God, if you don't believe in my God, you really can't be moral.
Yeah.
How do we know this, though? Because there are people like, and I'm thinking of the philosopher Leon Cass, who would talk oftentimes kind of going in the other direction of the wisdom of repugnance, that when, you know, we just know certain things, like in vitro fertilization are bad, abortion under all circumstances bad, et cetera. And we know that because we feel it and we're repulsed by it. How do you get out of that trap of where it's just the vibes?
I just have to add that Leon Cass thinks that eating an ice cream cone and licking it is repulsive, right, on the street, right?
You know, might be this... right about that, but I don't know. You should do that in a dark basement somewhere.
Yeah.
Or in a confessional booth. But... No, but, how do we step back so that we're not just kind of justifying
emoting
our bias.
Because, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, and I'm thinking like in terms of larger terms, it's like, oh, well, you know, we know like if those were American babies, however we define that, like they are worth saving. But, you know, the Chinese babies or, you know, the Japanese at a certain point would have been, no, those Chinese babies are absolutely not worth saving.
Yeah, so. Yeah, all of these biases come. So how do we know that it's, you know, it's true that human is something rare and precious, as Lao Xiang had said. Well, you know, I have an abstract argument for it, you know, that is, I actually think that the fact that we need to justify ourselves, that we, and in that process, we are thinking in terms of values, sometimes terrible values, you know, the ex-neo-Nazi had very, very bad values. But that move towards justifying oneself, putting oneself outside of oneself and asking what would really prove to me, you know, that I'm deserving, that that move itself is something, there's something intrinsically dignified about this. There's something estimable about that that puts us on a certain sphere. We, I believe, since I don't believe in God, I believe that we are bringing values into the universe, if not for us. Well, I don't know. You know, somewhere else in the universe and galaxy far, far away, who knows? Mm-hmm. But as far as we know right now, we are, you know, it's because we are here, we have evolved into these kinds of creatures that need to justify ourselves, that such a thing as values exists, that whole realm of values exists. And I think, you know, this, again, this is sort of abstract and philosophical, but to me, this I can finally get my head around a phrase that I could never cash out into exact meaning. You know, the intrinsic dignity of being human. To me, this is there's something dignified about this. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does to me. But I may, I'm kind of inclined to agree. You
know, yeah.
Partly because I see, you know, most of what is really good in the world, and it can take on a lot of petty and picayune kind of contemporary political differences, but that liberal push to, you know, where you're talking about, you know, we have the right to, you know, to our own lives, we need to respect the lives of others, and then we need to figure out a way to add something to the universe. Do you think that, you know, if we talked about things in those terms, given, you know, we've massified existential angst, everybody now, you know, everybody now can afford, you know, the idea that, oh, I got to justify myself to myself and possibly to outside people. Do you feel like if we talked more about this in these terms, we would just have a better conversation?
Well, I really do. Because, and for one thing is, you know, just seeing one another, no matter how much we disagree with how, you know, the other is ministering to this, to see that deeply human need and something estimable, and that is present wherever, you know, a human life is, wherever there's a human life, this is taking place. I don't know, to me, this is so cliché-ish, but it does open my heart. It opens my heart, and to try to imagine my way into, okay, you know, I'm going to start with this basic need that we both share, and look how this person's
are
going about it.
Are there moments that you can point to, if we're in a kind of expanded or expansive kind of crisis of mattering these days, and, you know, are there moments in time where there's something happens where, and it's not like, oh, we, you know, it's World War II and we realize that we all have a common goal for the next foreseeable few years, but where societies and the individuals in them, you know, start to actually think about this stuff in a productive, conducive way that's conducive to more, and I'm going to mispronounce it, eudaimonia.
Well, I think, you know, if we really put this on the table and start thinking about it, and seeing one another in these terms and seeing the right of everybody to pursue their mattering as they see it, which would involve some societal changes. You know, there can't be people from on high telling us what is the right way to go about this. If I could use Hayek, you know, I actually think that they're, you know, that Hayek said, you know, about production and allocation of resources, there can't be a commissar on it because of the knowledge problem, right? That the knowledge is dispersed, it's tacit, and it's dynamic, it's ever changing. And there's an exact correlation you can draw with mattering.
Again, which is also part of the modern project, right? That we go from, top down is the wrong term, but kind of hierarchical people from on high dictating terms of things to this distributed, you know, whether it's an economic market or a knowledge market or a cultural market.
Exactly.
Of experiments running simultaneously, people opting in and opting out.
Yeah. And it changes. And people, you know, I have learned from these decades of talking to people about it, it's kind of tacit. You have to draw it out. It's not foremost in their minds.
So Hayek always used the example of language, that everybody knows how to speak, but very few people actually know the rules that govern speech.
Exactly right. Yeah. But, you know, and it is, and it's very local. Mm-hmm. And only the person has firsthand knowledge, that first person knowledge of what lights up their life. You know, the first requirement of a good mattering project is that it is for you.
Now I feel like I'm in conversations with my dissertation committee where they were like, whatever you do, you have to really be excited about it. You know, because otherwise you will never get out of bed, or you'll find reasons to do everything other than that.
Exactly right. And, you know, and we get these mattering projects handed to us, you know, by our parents, by our teacher, by status, you know. And so I think, you know, societal changes, I'm not a real expert on this kind of practical application, but I can see that, you know, room for the individual, you know, to pursue mattering as it would best benefit them, you know. So, for example, you know, caregivers, you know, who can barely make a living, you know, those who scratch out their life. You know, if you've ever spent time with, you know, with nurses or you know, or elder care, you know, these are extraordinary people with great talents, which, you know, are not respected, and it's not what I want my child to grow up to be. I would like my child to be somebody who would want to do that, but who, you know, who could barely survive because, well, I have a child who's a poet, so I, and I'm very, very proud of that, but yeah, she can barely survive, right? So, you know, so to open up, you know, that some things have status in the way they were pushing, for example, you know, STEM. I love STEM, right? That lights up my life, but...
Forcing people who... It doesn't work for
it. It doesn't.
Increases social misery. It doesn't alleviate it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So there can't be... It has to be sort of opened up to the great differences between us and recognizing that in these great differences, there are some people who add to society and some people who... totally detract. And some of the people who have the highest status detract. Right. They are making life more disordered than
we are not going to be able to talk about your genius grant and what it felt like to win that. We'll save that for a future conversation because we're out of time.
You know, it's tattooed somewhere on me, genius.
Yes, that's right. It looks, MacArthur looks a little like Goebbels, right?
Right, yes.
But I've been talking with Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein. The book is The Mattering Instinct. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Nick. This has been fun.